The British Podcast Awards are now on, and Distinct Nostalgia needs your help. The power to crown the next Listener's Choice Award is in your hands. Your support will help Distinct by MIM bring even more great programmes to you. Vote now at britishpodcastawards.com/vote and search for Distinct Nostalgia. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to another Distinct Nostalgia by MIM.
Brought to you in partnership with Life Rooms and Merseycare NHS Foundation Trust. Staying well, staying home.
Now, back in the heyday of television, the ITV regions competed to get big comedy shows on the network. Thames and London Weekend were among those offering some real gems, but another company had a share of the sitcom spoils, and that was Yorkshire Television. Yes, Kirkstall Road in Leeds, the only ITV building to remain intact to this day, it's now home to Emmerdale's interior sets, is where many of ITV's comedy classics were filmed. Rising Damp, In Loving Memory, That's My Boy, A Bit of a Do, You're Only Young Twice, Duty Free, Says Les, The New Statesman, The Gaffer, Oh No, It's Selwyn Froggitt, Magic Hour Morris. Yorkshire was prolific, and many of the shows were penned by Lincolnshire-based writer Eric Chappell, who had a gift for sharp observational comedy. One of his Yorkshire-made gems was the hospital sitcom Only When I Laugh. And I'm H-A-P-P-Y to tell you that MIM's Ashley Byrne has been given the chance to chat to none other than Norman Binns, otherwise known as Christopher Strawley. I think it's Strawley.
And do people always get that right? Obviously it's Strawley, but a lot of people say Strawley, don't they?
Well, yes. Yeah. Yes, they, yes. Strawley was, yeah, my grandfather was Swiss, so it's a German-Swiss name, and He dropped the umlaut when he became anglicised. So we anglicised it to Strawley. And I was at school and I was always called Strawberry. And that's the way I remember it. Strawley. Head of straw.
My name's Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E. Yes. And nobody ever gets it right. So it's
really?
Byron, Bryn.
Oh, but, really?
No, for some reason, you know, and you'd think because most, if you go to Ireland, everyone's called Byrne.
Yes, I've known a few Byrnes, so I was all right with you.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, we get off to a good start because we understand each other's names. That's good. Okay, so Christopher, going back, you started your... Well, first of all, how did you... Well, we're talking about the Bristol Vic and all the rest of that kind of thing. But how did you... Where did your interest in acting come from?
It's one of those things I always, in a funny sort of way, knew I was going to do. And I remember standing there asking my English school teacher if I could be in the school play one year when I was, what, about 13, 14? And thinking, yes, I'm starting now. And I was a walk-on in As You Like It. No words at all. And then the next year I played Algy in The Importance of Being Earnest. And then Marlowe in She Stoops to Conquer the year after that. And I was on my way.
How did you get the place at the Bristol Vic?
Well, I went to RADA. I trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, where there was seven terms in those days, which was 2 years and a third. And then I auditioned for Bristol Old Vic. And I started down there with Jeremy Irons and Tim Pigott-Smith and Simon Cadell.
Yeah.
The four of us all down there working as ASMs, which is assistant stage manager acting stage manager. So what we did was we acted small parts, but then we made the tea and we went on the book and we helped make the props and we built the set. So it was wonderful. In those days, you got an all-round education. You learned a bit about everything and everybody's jobs, which is so important. Mm. And it's sad to say that the rep system, which is what Bristol Old Vic was a forerunner of, doesn't exist anymore. And so we don't have the training ground that we used to have.
How easy was it to get a place at RADA? I mean, compared to today?
I don't know how it is today. When I applied, there were 1,500 applications for 24 places. So it was never a shoo-in. Mm. And in fact, I had to go back two or three times to sort of make sure that they wanted me. And yes, it was one of those things that was very nerve-wracking at the time. But fortunately for me, they had me, and I had very happy 2.5 years there. And then went, as I say, straight down to Bristol Old Vic, where I stayed for a year and a half, did two or three seasons.
Fantastic. And of course, that was, you know, Bristol or Vic, it was one of the regions of the UK, you know, sat in the southwest and whatever. And you know, I was talking to a couple of younger actors recently who were saying to me, people who'd come from other parts of the country, who were saying to me, you know, really today, if you want to make it in acting, you have to base yourself in the capital, you have to base yourself in London. And is that something, do you think, that's changed a bit? Because, you know, we'll talk in a minute about your time at Yorkshire Television and various other places where you did lots of things in television and whatever. But is sadly that the way it's gone, do you think? Do you think it is now all about the capital, it's all about London again?
I think it probably is. But because we don't have the repertory system, which most big towns, and certainly every city, in my day, what I thought was the golden age of television and acting, it was every, as I say, every town, every city had its own rep company, and so you could go and get a job there. Now I don't know how you start. I'm very fortunate that I don't want to start now, and I, none of my children want to do it either. So
go on, do it all over again.
Yes, not with this body.
I mean, you're right, aren't you? Because I mean, things like Coronation Street, the Oldham rep was a big supplier of people's Coronation
Street. Yes, it was. Yes, absolutely. And Bristol, Old Vic was wonderful. So many people started down there. What was good in those days was that we could try things out. We had eight shows a week. And one day you'd say, let's try it that way. And then, well, that didn't work. Let's try it another way. And then by the end of the week or the second week, you'd worked out what was going to be good and what would work and what wouldn't work.
So the experimentation.
Yes, you were, there was the freedom to do that so that when we got our chances in television, people of my age, we knew what to do. And we were ready for it. And it was ready for us because that's why we had the best television drama and comedy in the world, because we had such a grounding potential from the repertory system.
So how would you have been when you were at the Bristol Vic then? What was it, a period would that have been? Were you late teens, early 20s?
I'd done a teacher training course first. Okay. My parents were wonderful. They said, we'll support you with your acting desires if you do something else first. So I went to teacher training college and trained to be a teacher for maths and science. And followed my own interest, had a Catholic taste in the drama, which was great. As I say, I got a very Catholic education and qualified for that. And then while I was about to qualify, I applied to RADA and got in there. So I was wonderfully lucky and got 5.5 years as a student. And I got a grant, which in those days was wonderful. But nowadays you couldn't. From Suffolk County Council, God love them, they gave me another grant, having paid for me to go to teacher training college, to go on to RADA. So I was a half a kept man for 5.5 years.
So there was a little bit of luck, but an awful lot of hard work.
Yes, it was. Yes. Yes. But fun at the same time. Yes, everything's hard work if you want to do it right, isn't it?
Now, you've had a pretty varied career. I mean, we'll talk about Only When I Laugh in a moment, which is the one thing that a lot of people will always remember you for, really. Everyone thinks of you as Norman Binns. You'll always be Norman Binns to a lot of us. But you did lots of other things and a real variety of stuff. I mean, I remember growing up in the 70s, and we have period dramas today, of course, but there were some massive period dramas in the 70s, and you were in one of them, weren't you? You were in the Edward the Seventh.
Yes, I played Winston Churchill in that, which was fun. When I was a kid, we used to have a play of the month, which was so exciting. What is sad now, you don't get a play of the decade. and that was a series, Timothy West playing Edward, lots of lovely people, and they wanted me for Winston Churchill. And
the young Winston, was it?
Young, well, yes. He was, when Edward died, he was sort of in his 30s, I think.
Yes.
And I had the immortal line, "It is the end of an era," which of course isn't how he would have said it at that age, but I had to give an inkling of, otherwise people would say, who's he pretending to be?
And of course, playing up against Timothy West, who's played Winston Churchill many times, of course.
Yes, he has since. I don't think he had by then. This was a long time ago. Yeah. Long time ago. And he and I did a play together at Leeds Playhouse about 10 years ago now. It was fun to do something live with him.
Yes, absolutely. And you starred in, you were in that, and you were in another series you were in called, was it Raffles you were in? Raffles?
Yes, Tony Valentine and I.
Yeah.
About a gentleman crook, gentleman thief.
And you were his sidekick, is that right?
I was a sidekick, Bunny, his sidekick. It was interesting because it was written by Hornung, who was the brother-in-law of Conan Doyle, who had a great success with Sherlock Holmes. And so the brother-in-law thought, I'll turn this on his head, and he did the baddie version. So we were a couple of gentlemen Anthony Valentine played Raffles, who was used to play cricket for England. And then we used to do burglarious things at night time and sort of go and steal jewels and diamonds and things.
What was your ambition at that particular stage? Because you're talking about the 1970s, it seems as though you had a variety of things. You were doing all sorts of different things. And, you know, I think about it, I was born in the 70s. I think you always think of the period you grew up in as being the best period, don't you? Yeah. And to me, it was a sort of a glory period. But what was your great ambition? Where did you want to end up in acting? Where did you want to go with it?
I just wanted to, I remember talking to Tony about this and saying, I just want to be someone who they say, oh, get Strawley, he'll do a good job. And I loved the idea of doing lots of different things. My great hero was Laurence Olivier, and I loved the fact that he would change his face and his body and he'd walk differently for every part. And that, to me, is what acting was about. Nowadays, it's not like that. You play yourself, basically, which is one of the hardest things to do, but yourself with different hats on, and that's what happens. So I wanted a challenging career, which took me in lots of different directions, and I'm fortunate enough to say I had that, and I enjoyed it all. And it was nice to mix. And the other thing about this country is you can do television and films and West End and everything without having to move. If you're in America, you've got to go to either the East Coast or the West Coast and then choose which one you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in the 70s, of course, it was a very much a heyday of British comedy in terms of TV comedy on both BBC and ITV. There was a lot going on. I remember the BBC being awash with comedies. ITV, most nights there'd be a comedy on, whether it was George and Mildred or something on a Friday night, 8:30. It was comedy centric. Nowadays, you can't see hardly any at all, is there?
I mean, well, no. Well, I suppose the trouble is most of them have been done, haven't they? There's nothing new. Okay, you can take, like we did in Anyone Laugh, three characters and put them anywhere. But once you've explored most of these characters, the situations have already been tried and tested elsewhere. You're up a gum tree, really.
But I think the problem is that we don't have enough. In the old days, there was a lot more. When I say the old days, even 10, 15, even 15 years ago, there seemed to be a lot more observational comedy. We don't seem to be able to observe what we're doing these days. I mean, I know everyone's stuck behind, iPads and phones and all the rest of it constantly. Probably there's not much interesting to do comedy about. I don't know.
Well, that's probably true. No, I think you're right. But it doesn't mean to say that people shouldn't try.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 70s, you were a contemporary of, well, I'd like to talk a little bit about him if you can. You were a contemporary of Richard Beckinsale, weren't you?
Well, yes. He was a couple of years older than me, but we were RADA together. I remember he was in the fifth term, which when they were doing the Greeks, and I was in the first or second, and Stuart Wilson and I were chosen to sort of play walk-ons in Ajax, which was being played by Richard Beckinsale in a short tunic and a Roman sword and everything. And I remember then he was meant to be deadly serious, but he used to make us laugh like crazy. He had a wonderful sense of comic timing. So he was a good friend. And then when he died, they had already done the setup for the film of Rising Damp, which was a great sadness. And then they came through and asked me to do it. And my first reaction was, oh, my goodness. And then I thought, well, someone's going to have to do it, and I suppose it might as well be a friend of Richard's as somebody else. So I had a go at it. But I have to say, and it's been fairly well documented, yes, I had a miserable time. Leonard Rossiter, for whom I have the greatest respect as an actor.
A hard taskmaster,
and made it very difficult for me. We met, but they had gave us a drinks party in the evening before we started filming at Pinewood. And I went into the room and they're all there, and he said, we know it works well now. If it doesn't work, we're never to blame, won't we? That was his opening gambit. So we got off to a pretty poor start, and he always wanted me to play it like Richard would have played it, and I can understand it from his perspective, but from my perspective, I didn't want to do that because I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be played by me, and I was a different actor from Richard. And probably
you're a different character, weren't you?
It was the same words. Yeah. Exactly the same words. It's called a different character, but yes, it was. But so that was a bone of contention because Rossiter would keep saying, why can't you do it like Richard? Well, I'm a different actor for a start, and I want to make it my own. And the director, Joe McGrath, who was a lovely chap, seemed to be more on my side than Rossiter's, which annoyed Rossiter. So, no, it was the most miserable 4 weeks of my whole career working with Mr. Rossiter. We just had our second baby, and my wife blames me and him for not giving the support she needed at the time.
But you got lots of nice support from the other members of the cast.
Oh, Don Warrington. And Don Warrington. We had absolutely lovely. And Denham Elliott, too, yes. Who was in it, yeah. With whom I worked two or three times. So the rest were lovely, but the Bete Noire really was very difficult.
It was funny in those days. Every comedy seemed to get a film, didn't it?
Yeah, it did happen like that, didn't it? Porridge went on to do that. Yeah. Only When I Laugh. We never did.
No,
sadly.
You didn't go on. Maybe they decided not to bother with them after into the '80s. I think they did actually finish around 19. Maybe Rising Damp was the last one.
I think it probably was one of those, wasn't it?
Yeah. Talking about Richard Beckinsale for a second.
Yes.
He was what was quite interesting about Richard Beckinsale was he was from the Midlands. Mm-hmm. He had quite a Midlands accent, actually. If you listen to him carefully. Mm. But I've seen him in lots of things where he's actually. You hear that accent, you know, those tones. Which
yes, I think that's probably right. Yes.
What was it about him that was special, do you think? I mean, people obviously, you know, it's a long time ago now since he died and whatever, and obviously it was shocking at the time. But
it was very shocking. And even now, a few years ago, I worked with his lovely wife, Judy Lowe. It was just such a shock. And he was a lovely, engaging, talented man. He had a wonderful gift of timing. If you watch any of those Porridges, the two of them working together is just magic. They make the text come alive off the page with Ronnie Barker. He just had an innate quality which worked so magnificently, and it was a great, great shame that he didn't last long enough to show it to greater advantage.
Absolutely. Now, Only One Laugh, because that was probably the pinnacle in some respects of your career. Would you say it was the pinnacle of your career? That's what most people would probably say.
No, you probably wouldn't say. I wouldn't say it's a pinnacle. I'd say it's the thing that people used to recognise me for most, and to which I will always be very grateful.
Yes.
But in terms of acting career, no. There are other things which I've done.
What are the things are you most proud of?
I'm probably most proud of Eustace and Hilda, which was a trilogy, an L.P. Hartley trilogy I did with Susan Fleetwood and Billy Whitelaw and Robert Stevens. It was a film, a three-part film, which we did up in Hunstanton, up in Norfolk, directed by Desmond Davis. That was something to really get my teeth into. We took months filming it. And then theatre-wise, the happiest thing and the most rewarding in many ways was Wind in the Willows, which I did at the Old Vic, the National Theatre production written
by... Who did you play in that?
Ratty.
Ratty.
Oh, Ratty. Okay. It was a bigger part than Toad, actually. It's the biggest part in the play. And it's a lovely part. Once you've learned to cope with the tail and having your ears stuck on and whiskers by a makeup girl every night. But to play the Old Vic was such a thrill, because that was a place where I first saw Sir Laurence Olivier when I was, about 16 years old, and queued up and saw that. And to actually play and look up at that chandelier every night and think, my goodness, yes, I am a lucky guy, I'm here. And we did that for 6 months, 243 performances, and there wasn't ever one I didn't look forward to doing or enjoy. It was a wonderful script. By Alan Bennett, God love him, and a super cast and a wonderful director, and we packed him in, and it was a very, very happy time.
Do you prefer the theatre compared to anything else?
Yes, I suppose I used to. It's the one place where you're in charge. The curtain goes up, you have to tell a story, and at the end you bow and you go home. Everything else is down to technical wizardry, and you can be left on the cutting room floor, literally. So that is the advantage of it. And as I said earlier, you can say, well, that didn't work very well tonight. Yes. Let's try it that way. Ah, we've found it. That's how it works, which you can't do in television.
No. Nonetheless, though, of course, Only When I Laugh was done in front of a studio audience.
We had a studio audience of 400 people.
Yes. That leads to Kirkstall Road, doesn't it?
Yep, yeah. That's right, yes. Friday nights, a lot of pressure on that. It's one of the most pressurised things we ever did as actors, I think, because you had a week to learn it and do it. And then in the studio, you have, it was usually an hour and a half or 2 hour slot to get it all in, a half an hour program. Mm. And it wasn't just you messing around and getting it wrong. It was the technical guys, the lighting going wrong, the cameras breaking down and everything with a live audience. And it's a lot of pressure. Mm.
And pressure on the audience, I suppose, because if you're having to take a few times and do, you know, a gag isn't the same two or three times afterwards, is it?
Absolutely, absolutely right. Yes, you can say to the audience, please laugh just as much as you did the first time, but of course they don't, because it's not, the spontaneity is lost. But the rehearsals were fun. We used to rehearse in, that was one of the crazy things, we used to rehearse in London. And then on a Thursday night, we'd chase up to Leeds and record it on a Thursday and come down on the Saturday and start rehearsing the next one on the Sunday. But there was one year, I think it was the third year, because we did it for 4 years, when I was doing Alan Ayckbourn's Season's Greetings at the Apollo Theatre in Shaftesbury Avenue at the same time. So on a Friday night, my understudy was on, and then we recorded it while the show was on in London, up in Leeds, with an audience, a live audience, as we were saying, 400 people. And then Jimmy Bonham and I used to get on the sleeper to come down, because he was doing something else too. Came down to London on the Saturday, did two shows, and then started rehearsing the next Only When I Laugh on the Sunday. So it was a 7-day, pretty intense week.
What a nightmare. But they used to do quite a lot of episodes in a series back then, didn't they?
We used to do seven. One year we did eight, because we did an extra run, a Christmas one. So there are 29 episodes flying around. The great thing about Only When I Laugh was you get up in the morning, go to work, and then get back into bed again. So that was very nice.
What did you feel about the part when you were offered it? What did you feel about that role?
Well, I'd learnt that by then they sort of thought of me as the boy next door, the naive twerp. So I thought, well, I might as well cash in on it if that's what they want. He was remarkably naive, but we're all such silly characters. But it didn't make sense. It didn't worry me at all, because...
And had you worked with any of those actors before?
No, I hadn't. No, Jimmy Bolan, Peter Bowles, and Richard Wilson, of course. Yeah, no. Or Derek Branch.
Yeah.
No, I hadn't worked with any of them before. Or the director, Vernon Lawrence.
But it was quite a simple idea of Eric's, really, wasn't it? But it worked really well.
It did. He'd written some beautiful lines and some beautiful characters, and it was very simple and very straightforward idea, but then he fleshed it out so well that it became a classic, really.
I think it's a classic. I think it's one of the best, actually. And, of course, the theme tune was fantastic as well. That became popular.
Yeah, it's marvellous with Jimmy singing it. Yes. Yeah. Great fun.
And of course, the set was quite simple too, wasn't it? It was a bit like, you think of Are You Being Served? There wasn't much in Are You Being Served set, really. It was just one big, you know, where that was the same with yours, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was just the ward with the three beds in, and then peripheral bits built around it to change every week.
Yeah.
We only ever twice went out of the hospital.
So it probably made quite good radio. It was very much about words, wasn't it?
Yes. I think they did it on the radio.
Did they really?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Yes, it was very much words, and in those days Eric had a wonderful imagination for funny lines.
Absolutely. Well, I still watch it, and I think it still makes me laugh today, 30-odd years later, which is fantastic. What was special about working with Peter and Jimmy and Richard? What were they like to work with? Because I think, personally, Figgis was, when I look back at Jimmy's career, I think that, for me, that was my favourite character of all the people he's played.
Really? Yeah, I can understand it. Jimmy is someone who I have the highest respect. He's a wonderful actor. He learns his lines. He comes in ready to do it, and he does it. And there's no messing around. He's just grafter. And always a delight and a joy to work with. I see what you mean. He was... he's done so many jolly good things, but that figures he really did make his own.
And yes.
The manic quality he had was just a delight to watch.
Mm. And, of course, Peter's done lots and lots of different things. But, again, it was a perfect part for him.
Absolutely, it was. Yes, yes. It could have been written for him. Well, in fact, I think he almost, by the time we got to the pilot and the first series, Eric knew who he was writing for, so I think that it was very well designed, really.
And where was it supposed to be? Was it supposed to be in Leeds?
I think it probably was. I can't remember. I just remember the first episode, looking out the window, and meant to be able to see the daffodils tossing their heads in sprightly dance. And we just imagined it was a hospital somewhere. It probably was in Leeds, but I don't think it really matters. It could have been anywhere.
What do you remember about it? Is there any particular storylines you remember where, you know, you thought were particular fun?
We'll be back after a quick break.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man.
Y'all
trying,
already?
Yeah, I'm trying to get them on there.
Look,
we all artists, man. We go, you feel me? We gonna have this, like,
Bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit
don't
right
play
now.
With this
I
shit.
Gonna lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it. No. Take that shit seriously.
There was fun every week. One that I didn't think was fun was the Christmas one we talked about, which was about a young boy coming in who turned out to be a firefighter and tried to set fire to the place, which I'd never quite understood. And it wasn't on the same level as all the others. I remember Deirdre, my fiance, who was coming in, played by the lovely Diane Bull, who most sadly died. Much too young, she had a brain tumour. She was in the same play with me in the West End at the Apollo, the season's greetings. She was lovely. I think I seem to remember I had two different mothers, or was that?
You had lots of teddy bears.
I did. I had four. Had a different teddy bear each time. Each time we came to make the new series, the last teddy bear had disappeared. So obviously been nicked by somebody. So well, the fourth one I nicked, and I went on the radio and actually auctioned him off and got three figures for him, which went to charity. So that was rather good.
Now, it was one of the sort of first major roles for the person we later got to know as Victor Meldrew, wasn't
Indeed,
it?
Yes.
And but a very distinctive part for him too.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Wonderful, charming chap. As well known at that time as a director, as for his acting, both of which
I always remember him as at. I always remember him as a barrister on Crown Court.
Do you? I think I missed that one. I bet he was good though, wasn't
he? Was
he?
Very good, yeah.
Yes. No, he was.
Did you ever end up on Crown Court?
I don't think I did. No.
I think Crown Court in those days I think was a bit like sort of the Bill and Doctors have become, if you know what I mean, where everyone sort of went in for a little bit part and that kind of thing.
I did Harriet's Back in Town, which is the same sort of time, and that was fun.
So in terms of Only When I Laugh then, I mean, yeah. I personally think it's one of those kind of things that could be done today. Mm-hmm. I think you could get you three back together. What would you do? Would you build for that?
Absolutely. I think it'd be in a geriatric ward and it could be could be quite amusing. Yeah, I think it was suggested. I think I suggested it to Eric. But for some reason, Eric seems to have been passed by now. He's still trying to do things, and I can't for the life of me understand why they don't snap him up. But times change, as we were saying, don't they?
All sorts of people seem to have been overlooked in more recent times.
Yeah.
And yet, I think they could probably still write very, very reflective observational comedy.
I think they probably could. I think you're right. But it's just the passing of time, isn't it? And there's so many actors who can still do it, but they don't get a chance nowadays because the young talent comes along and they don't want the old fogies. And that's just the way life...
Well, reflecting on that just for a second, you often get female actors who are very vocal about this, who say that older women, there's not enough parts for older women. You know, Julie Walters often talks about it, various other people have talked about it. Yeah. Frances de la Tour's talked about it. Not enough parts for older women. Are there enough parts for older men today?
Probably not. Lots of my chums don't do as much work as I think they should, and I know they could certainly do well. So I think it probably is true.
It's an obsession with youth, doesn't it?
I think that's right. And by the time it comes full circle, it'll be too late because we'll either have dropped off this mortal coil or won't be able to do it anymore. So,
now, in Only When I Laugh, you were one of the young, you were the young heartthrob in some respects to some people. I'm sure
I was the only young one, so I suppose I had to be the heartthrob.
What kind of feedback did you get from that part from the public?
It was immense. It was quite incredible when you think about it. In those days, there were only three or four television channels, so we used to get 19 million people a night watching it, which meant that's a third of the country. When I walked down the street the next morning, one in three people would have seen me on television the night before, which was strange in one way. And I don't think I handled it as well as I could. I was probably a bit too young, but I used to walk down the street looking at the floor because if I ever met people's eyes, they'd say, where do I know you from? You teach my son to play the guitar. Or you know, all that would go on. So I didn't meet people's eyes, which was not a very good communication tool, which is what I'm teaching now. People would regardless of whether you're with your family and young kids, come up to you and say, oh, hello, I've seen you last night, and oh, you're wonderful, oh, yeah, you look uglier on here than you do on telly. All that sort of rubbish would go off. And they'd say to my wife, is it him? Is it him? Does he take sugar? All that, which I found rather imposing and rather difficult to cope with. Mm. There was one day, I remember we were at Alton Towers, with the whole family were having a nice day out up there, and a whole lot of school kids came up to me and said, oh, it's you. And I said, look, I'm sorry. I know I look a bit like that bloke on the telly, but I'm not him. I wish I was. It'd be fun, wouldn't it? But no, I'm not him. So can you tell everybody? Because otherwise I'm going to have a miserable day.
And they took that.
They took it. They said, oh, it's not him. Oh, that's right. It doesn't look like him, does it?
No. It is weird, isn't it? Fame is a funny thing. I mean, I must admit, I live in Manchester and often we'll see Coronation Street characters all over the place. And you end up, they're there all the time. And you'll be in the supermarket or whatever. And you'll end up saying hello to them just automatically, weirdly, because you see them every night of the week on the telly.
Yes, it is funny the way that happens, isn't it? Yes,
you know Rita for some reason.
Yes, you're a bit surprised when they don't say hello back. Yes.
It really has been great to meet you. Thank you, Chris.
This is Distinct Nostalgia by MIM, the home of a regular quiz testing your TV and film knowledge.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Star Trek, so can you ask me some questions on that, please?
I absolutely loved Paper Play. Was that presented by Susan Strang?
I'd like to have some questions about Coronation Street in the 90s.
How would you like to be crowned Distinct Nostalgia Mind of the Month and win a Distinct Nostalgia mug in the process? If you think you could answer random questions on both a chosen subject and if you get to the final, TV and film general knowledge, then drop us a message now on the contact page of the Distinct Nostalgia website, distinctnostalgia.com.
Take 23.
Distinct Comedy presents.
Oh, hello. I'm Jolyon Karp. I'm doing a voiceover.
Oh, hello.
Experience a day in the life of voiceover guy.
Take 13.
I'm playing a pirate.
Are you sure you're in the right place?
Written and performed by Jonathan Kidd.
Take 24.
Aha! Splice the main brace, me hearties. Get on down to Captain Jacob's boat supplies. Sail is now on. Get it?
Oh, good, let's treat that one as a run-through.
Aha!
Available now on the Distinct Comedy Podcast.
Okay then, can we do a series of less piratical wild ahas in threes and we'll splice them on? That okay, Paul?
The trials and tribulations of a life spent in voiceover.
Sorry, I only have two lemon with honey.
I'd like my coffee. I shall scream without a coffee.
New and original comedy.
Softer.
Aha!
Well, actually, on reflection, I'm not happy with them.
I like what we had, all rough and piratey.
Listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or I might have to give you a black spot.
That was blood out of a stone. Won't use him again.
And you can hear lots more programmes via the Distinct Nostalgia player. There's Hartley Hare and a Pipkins reunion.
So, Hartley, nice to meet you. Can I shake your paw?
You can shake
paw?
My hand, yes.
Is it a paw or
well,
a
it's
hand?
A paw, really. It's a paw. I call it a hand.
I remember you going to the dentist.
Oh, yes, I went to the dentist once.
And you weren't very happy about it,
no,
were
I wasn't
you?
Very happy about it. I hated it.
Corrie and Carry On star Amanda Barry remembers being a children's TV presenter in the 70s.
Because it was live, they were always either overrunning or underrunning, so there were mad people waving at you. Mm. I remember one day we were really underrunning. So I hopped on the wall and walked along it. Oh, I got in such trouble. They said, you are teaching children to walk on walls.
We're back in Hartley to meet the original female inspectors from Juliet Bravo.
So when you come to do any filming, you've got this skirt on and this jacket. And the coat was cold. The hat, the first hat we wore, wasn't reinforced. It wasn't a helmet. And I had a handbag. No pockets. There wasn't a single pocket in my jacket. I mean, talk about ill-equipped.
And there's even an appearance from Gonzo in our great Muppets reunion.
Dr. Gutnick works on me. I've had my nose lifted. I've had, you know, everything fixed. Everything's been lifted.
These programs and many more are all available now at distinctnostalgia.com. Get in touch via the Contact Us page on the website. Bye for now.
Distinct Nostalgia is brought to you in partnership with Life Rooms and Mersey Care NHS Foundation Trust. We've lots of activities for you to do at home at liferooms.org. Staying well, staying home.